It's Monday, July 10th, 2006, and you're listening to Episode 9 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 9 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot, now featuring zany morning show noises and lots of funny personalities.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Energy-inducing.
And those, of course, are coming from Dan, and we also have Chad.
Hi.
And John.
Hey.
Down to a little bit of a smaller group than normal, but that's all right. We can still get a good show out of this without Adam or Phil or Axe sitting here screwing it all up for us.
This is true.
Now, you guys had something you were talking about on your way over here to record the podcast with setting.
We were talking about, like, overall genre of a campaign, I guess.
Not even genre, because we kept it to fantasy. I'd say the word is flavor.
Flavor,
basically, the trap we spoke of many campaigns, new and old alike, falling into was the Tour de Realm, as Dan calls it. The
gross.
The Hobbit-modeled adventure at which you must race between point of interest to point of interest, and the DM feels this compulsion to get as much out of his campaign setting as he can by stuffing as many NPCs and settings as he can.
So what we're talking about here, if I'm following you guys right, is we made some jokes in previous podcasts about the use of the Monstrous Manual as a plot.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about the use purely of a setting as a plot.
Yes. Right. We're talking about the use of a hardbound book or box as a dossier of NPCs and a list of places that must be visited in a game, or else it's a failure.
Yes, to define the or explain the Tour de Realm thing that John made reference to, I've sat in on several games. I know Chad has as well, and John, you may very well have too, where you get someone who's very familiar with the setting, who's very familiar with the novels, and is deeply enamored by them. It's just in love with them. And so when you get into the game, there really is only a minimal plot, if any at all. The big important thing is for you to go from place to place, seeing all these famous sites, meeting all these famous people, and getting marginally involved in all these major events of the book simply because the DM, and maybe the players too, but usually just the DM, is just head over heels in love with the setting.
Yeah, the characters are just sort of presented to you. You do minimal interaction with them. You certainly don't do anything that changes anything major at all.
Oh, no. And it's not even a trap exclusively for those who are experienced and intimate with the campaign setting. A lot of people will pick up a campaign setting, never having seen it or any other setting before, and just think that it's all there and it's all got to be used.
Yeah.
Why is it so distinctly D&D?
I blame Tolkien myself. I think it gets back to the old token that a lot of fantasy novels fall into, modern fantasy novels, and a lot of D&D campaign settings and campaigns fall into of, you know, all modern fantasy is travel 1,000 miles to chuck a ring in a volcano.
Well, I actually, if I was to think about it just off the top of my head, I would pin it on something else, which is the big realm, small world syndrome. And what I mean by that is, let's take something like Star Wars. In Star Wars, you have this massive galaxy, big realm. But really, all that matters in that big galaxy, all they really defined until some of the expansion source books for the RPG and such, was Luke and Vader and Leia. And this very, very tiny number of worlds and this very small group of people. And honestly, anything that's happening outside of that group of people is either insignificant or so much less significant, it might as well be insignificant.
I would concur with both of your assessments and add another factor, which is the appetite for sheer volume that a lot of RPG players and producers have cultivated. We just want more, and that's it.
Yeah. What's wrong with setting a campaign in one city? You know, you certainly, if you bought like a box set that has maps and does a whole campaign world of gods and major characters and that sort of thing, you don't want to have one city in there. You want to have multiple cities and whatnot. That just doesn't mean you have to use them all.
Right.
But what's wrong with, as a game master and players, setting a campaign in one city, one castle, and being involved in the comings and goings of that castle?
I just don't understand what the problem is with understanding this real simple rose is a rose sort of thing of a good plot for a game is a plot.
Right.
Not a setting. I mean, a setting's where a plot occurs.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what you're going to fight or who you're going to kill. That's just encounters along the way. It's not who you're doing it with in terms of big bad NPCs and mm-hmm. glittering.
That's what players are for.
Yeah, that's what players are for. Mm-hmm. This, you know, your plot is your plot.
What is the definition of a plot as far as role-playing games are concerned?
You know, and this is where I think, you know, without having thought of this beforehand, I'm almost guaranteeing that any definition I give right now, because it's not going to have been well thought out in advance, is probably going to be wide open for nitpicking.
It's a hard question.
Yeah, it is. And I guess really what I'm trying to say, and maybe a better way to phrase it, because, I mean, really and truly, a plot is simply what happens to the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, you could use the setting as plot and monsters as a plot. But so let's use a different term here, that it's not plot versus non-plot, but a good plot versus a bad plot. And a good plot should have so many elements of story and of action that are wholly original and wholly unique to that particular campaign that you can't possibly have derived it purely from setting, purely from the Monstrous Manual, or any of these other very narrow things.
Right.
Let's talk, if we're going to talk about things that are unique to D&D, we threw Star Wars in with that one because it kind of suffers from the same thing.
Mm.
But if we're going to talk about things that are primarily unique to D&D, let's talk about another one, which is alignment.
Yes.
Alignment's another one that, you know, someone can send us an email and correct us on this, but I'm not aware of any other game out there that
uses
alignment as a statistic.
Or even not an alignment per se, like another game that uses a moral compass, either an evil moral compass or a good moral compass, as a stat, as something that affects the game. Other than just, you know, you write up your character background and say, this is a bad guy.
In D&D, it's just mechanically relevant as your strength score.
Yeah.
Primarily for the use of circle against good, circle against evil, alignment targeting spells, or alignment activated items. Mm-hmm. And I think in one of the DMGs out there, they actually made the disclaimer that this wasn't an advanced debate on the nature of morality. It was to see whether you could use a Holy Avenger or whether you got hit by a circle of protection against evil.
You know what, though? I think that inadvertently, then, they've done a good thing. Personally, I don't like alignments. I think that they pigeonhole people and it forces you inside a box that you sometimes you're not allowed out of and yada, yada, yada. But I think that it is a game mechanic that forces you to think about the personality of your character. And,
you know,
that's a really cool thing.
It is cool, but I'd almost pin it on something else, which is the worldview that goes into the game. Because if we rewind D&D backwards, it's common knowledge. D&D came from Tolkien. Tolkien drew from myths, mostly of the British Isles.
Tolkien didn't invent D&D, but the concepts.
Right, he didn't invent dwarves and elves. All these things were taken from the myths of the British Isles.
Right.
And if you look at the fairy tales of the time and compare them to modern day stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's take something a little more modern, like BattleTech, our beloved game we keep falling back to. If you look at the BattleTech stories, the human element is fairly complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You have people that you may like or dislike, or people that may be doing things that are right or wrong, but you cannot really define most people in the plot line simplistically in terms of this guy's a good guy, this guy's a bad guy,
because
the good guy's got skeletons in his closet and the bad guy has redeeming qualities.
Yeah.
But in D&D, drawing from Tolkien, from the fantasy or the fairy tales of the British Isles, these fairy tales, their tradition of storytelling was to teach human virtues in a way that was so infinitely simple that you did boil people down to the shining knight was a good guy.
Right.
And if he had any skeletons in his closet, it was few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
And the bad guy was just this horrible, wretched, insidious, deformed monster who didn't have all these nuances and streaks of good in him. And so therefore, maybe to keep that fairy tale sort of feel, D&D needs a specific alignment. You have to come into this pretty well defined.
I think that's something of a misassessment, actually, Dan, of Tolkien anyway, and it may be one that the D&D creators made themselves. I think Tolkien's evil is pure and wretched evil, but his good is checkered. Explain Boromir. Explain Faramir. There were Gondorian men who were misguided and worked badly, but were good.
And I could somewhat draw that from, you know, in fairy tales, the unlikely hero, which is what most of them were. I just got done a while back reading a book called The God of the Fairy Tales that talks about the types of lessons that fairy tales were designed to teach and puts them up side by side, which is a discussion I just am woefully underprepared tonight to go into any depth on. But no, I see. I think you're right that the good is very checkered. But and you can see that as well, like La Morte Arthur. Yeah. You have Lancelot, who's a lecher, for example.
You have Merlin, who is a good guy, but is enabling a lot of
evil.
Yeah, a lot of evil.
But, you know, the evil's still very well defined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not redeemed evil. You're out to destroy them. You're not out to reconvert Darth Vader. You're out to make Venus Morgul topple.
Yeah, and talking about alignment, I realize because of its necessary mechanic within D&D, you almost have to assign it from the gate.
Yeah.
Because, for example, some classes are required to have a certain alignment, and even if you don't have that, you've got, can you pick up the Sword of Good? How do you respond to the protection against evil spell? Things like that. But something I tried in a game once, and actually worked out pretty well, was I drew a little 4x4 box. I mean, almost like a little, or not 4x4, rather, 2x2. Mm-hmm. So a box with four squares in it, kind of like almost like a Punnett square. And I had, in one box was lawful, one box was chaos, one box was good, one box was evil. And as people did actions in the game that were uniquely, you know, towards one persuasion or the other, I'd give them a little tick mark there. And over time, they would start to form a pattern where even if they thought their character was lawful good, if they broke the law too many times, they suddenly found themselves, well, no, actually, you're more of a neutral good or chaotic good, and let the characters define their alignment by action rather than by assignment.
I might be a little apprehensive about that. You can let your characters define themselves by action, but someone has to interpret that action.
Right.
And as someone who primarily plays rather than GMs, I might take some degree of irritation if my GM told me that my lawful good character was actually chaotic good.
Yeah, and that's a debate I actually had with Mike, who's not involved with these podcasts a few times, is, you know, I do an action that for maybe in my mind I can justify as good, but you're calling it evil or vice versa. And where does that line get drawn? But really, I guess within something like D&D, you kind of have to enforce that by one person's standard. Because, like, for example, even within the Pantheon, you have gods doing things that I would personally find as horribly evil and subversive. But the realm has labeled those actions as good. So there is a single standard they're going by. They're not chasing around sort of the moral relativism and the loose interpretation of things that's popular in early 21st century and late 20th century thought.
Yeah, and I will cede you that point. We've all seen the lawful good paladin, because he has to be lawful good, who is killing grandmas, but it's really for a good reason, and this, that, and the other. And I will give the DM license to stomp down in a case like that.
Yeah.
How do you feel about using alignment as a balancer? And what I mean by that is you can look in certain games, for example, D&D. Second edition paladin was really one of the more powerful character classes.
The character class. There was no one who peered him.
Right, it was, especially in the day before the big fighter feats of third edition. I mean, you effectively had a fighter with more.
Right.
The only thing he didn't get was what some of specific weapon specializations or something like
that. Yeah, fighters, I think, got one weapon specialization, which was sort of a feat before there were such things as feats.
Right.
But it was not a balancer. Yeah.
But the big limiter on the paladin that supposedly brought them back into scope was the fact that you had to behave yourself.
Yeah. You had to be lawful good, and I've never understood that. Why is it a disadvantage to not be a jerk and to be a nice person who doesn't lie? Like in the World of Darkness, the Vampire Masquerade, there is a disadvantage of being truthful. And I'm not a Vampire the Masquerade expert here, so I'll probably be corrected. But it's my understanding it's not a compulsive truth-teller disadvantage. Like somebody asks you a question and you just have to Tourette's-like burst out with the honest answer and giving away the secrets of the party. But it's a matter of you're not a liar, so you can't lie. I always took that. I always took that disadvantage because I think lying is a bad thing, you know, in myself and in my characters. I don't understand why it's considered a bad thing to be an honest person or to be a good person.
That's what I found too. Is I always thought it made a poor disadvantage for two reasons. Reason one is, like you said, I mean, for me personally, my characters all tend to be good guys anyway. So I don't have a problem. It's no stretch for me to play a lawful good character. The second thing I found is, whether it's in my games or other games and I'm playing the good guy or somebody else's, you can always get around it.
Yeah.
That if you want to rob the king blind, you just arrange it so the paladin isn't there when you do it, and you've got a semi-believable story of where the gold came from. And really, this doesn't serve as any negative to the party.
Mm-hmm. I think the lawful good as a balancer might have been cooked up by the sort of player who takes chaotic neutral so he can do anything.
Right.
It's weird that in the same handbook that you see written, alignment is not a straitjacket, alignment is not a straitjacket, this is a roleplay tool, and you have to be lawful good so that you're balanced.
Yeah. Right, and if you violate that, depending on your edition, you can either lose your abilities, or you can lose all kinds of stuff in second edition.
Second edition,
you get straight up stripped.
They just cut you in half if you screwed up with your alignment. Yeah, I think you're right, though, that maybe in the eyes of someone who doesn't have storylines that are quite as complex and detailed as ours are, my mind honestly almost goes towards describing it as more mature, but I don't want to quite come off so pompous. But if you have someone who prefers, like John said, the chaotic neutral characters and all that, maybe this is a big hit. Maybe that really does make it harder than to me it seems.
I don't know. How often do your D&D groups do nefarious things when they're supposed to be being good guys to achieve their ends?
Yeah, and I've heard it postulated many times, and I believe you've heard this too, Chad, and John, I just don't know your experience well enough, that I've heard people say that role-playing games are primarily about either A, breaking the law, or B, antisocial behavior. That even when, in most groups, and this is not true of all groups, but in most groups, even when you're the good guys, you're the good guys operating outside the bounds of the law, trying to tear down evil organizations and corrupt kings, and fundamentally, you spend all of your time violating the law.
Yeah, and you're unhindered by this cumbersome concept of due process or the justice of the court, and you can just go kick a butt.
And I said this in one of the past podcasts, too, is I hate it when players are so casual about killing someone. I think that it's too easy to steal things and to lie and to hurt people and to kill people. You know, this is supposed to be a role-playing game. You're supposed to be simulating reality. It is not easy, unless you're some sort of psychopath or you are pushed to an extreme limit, to whip out a gun and blow somebody's head off. Yet, in role-playing games, that is par for the course.
Right.
You know, if somebody says something you don't like, you kill them. In a lot of groups.
And I think part of the problem there, and not to hammer on D&D, but I think D&D lends itself towards this, is there's very little consequence.
Yeah.
And there's partially no consequence because game masters usually let their players act out their excesses.
Giggling the whole way.
Right, giggling the whole way. But I think in D&D it's made worse, and this actually get into a whole critique of the D20 system, which we may actually do this very podcast. But I think part of where that comes from is the level thing. That if you are a level 15 whatever, and you're in the town and you just want to rob, kill, maim, do whatever, there is no consequence. Nobody in the town can oppose you.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they can, like you said, just the GM and players giggling the whole way as they do it. So.
Yeah, at that level, it becomes either you can mow down the entire town, the militia are a bunch of warrior level ones, or the GM drops into level 20 wizard to turn you into a frog, and then the players cry, cop out, which it kind of actually is.
Yeah. But that kind of group, though, that extreme example of group, I mean, you're talking about like 14-year-olds.
Yeah, I am.
You're talking about 40-year-olds who are really 14-year-olds.
Yeah.
Before we dig into another heavy topic, let's get something lighthearted in here, because our banter's been, for us, very unusually serious today.
Yeah. Well, you don't have Adam whipping out
this
the jokes and yucking us up.
This is almost advice more than banter.
I know. We're so locked down today. And this actually wasn't planned.
Yeah.
No.
There's been conversations on our forums. And if you haven't stopped by, please do it. Feartheboot.com. We have email forums. We have a link on our link section to our audio mailbox forums. All kinds of ways you can get a hold of us. And there's a discussion on our forums about people asking us, you know, had we considered bringing just a little bit more order to the show?
Oh, God, I hope not.
I know. And it's almost like, you know, we said, yeah, we're going to look into that. But this was not even how we planned it. But here we are being kind of buttoned out and straight men today. So let's get into something a little bit more, you know, get back to our zany morning show roots.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Let me grab the air horn and the whoopee cushion.
Yeah. Let's go get the token midget and the guy who stutters and... Now, John, we're talking about antisocial behavior here.
We are.
Within the games. But sometimes those excesses don't remain inside of the game. I want you
No, they don't.
I want you to tell us your story about real violence and excess outside of the game.
All right. Disclaimer, I'm only friends with about half of the gaming group I'm about to describe. Well, real-life friends. I've talked to them all on the internet. So I've heard one side of this story. Supposedly, their GM was just so irritating and just yanked their chain from his GM chair day in and day out for years. I don't know why they put up with it, but whatever. And one night, over a game of X-Men on the GameCube, one of the players stabbed him. I think it was with a pen, but I am talking puncture wound, bleeding, physically attacked him over irritation built up for so long in his game world.
150 XP.
Yeah, I was about to say, I might not game under that DM again. I don't think he'd like me.
Yeah, I've actually never seen real violence at a game. But
I've seen people get really pissed off.
You've seen a gun drawn, haven't you,
No,
Dan?
I was not there for it. That was the story I was about to tell. I was not present for this, but several people I knew were present for this. There was a game going on in the basement of a hobby shop here locally. They had a downstairs area that had all these big tables set up so you could do your RPGs, or you had huge tables for terrain or whatever you wanted to do. And during this particular game, apparently tempers flared, and someone pulled out an actual 45 semi-automatic, loaded, locked, ready to go.
Wow.
And drew it on everyone.
And this was before Missouri concealed
yes,
carry.
Yes, so not only was this a completely outrageous action, but it was illegal.
Quite illegal.
I mean, even to have that gun was illegal. Forget pulling it out over a game, just having it was illegal. But he drew out an actual loaded 45 semi-automatic and started going kind of nuts. And one of the friends that we had there, they just managed to kind of distract the guy emotionally, because he apparently wasn't all there to begin with, obviously. And said to this guy, you know, oh, hey, that's a kind of cool gun. You mind if I look at it? And this guy was now distracted by yelling at somebody else and kind of just let him have it. And so they just took it from him and took it as far away from him as they could.
Wow.
But I can imagine, though, things like this happening. I mean, you get, it's no different, really, than, I guess, like a soccer riot.
Yeah.
You get enough people in a hobby that really care about it, and you're going to get the nutbag.
Well, it's guys like that that make people think that our hobby drives people to insanity.
Yeah.
It doesn't drive people to insanity. That guy brought something to the table before he ever touched a role-playing
game. Right, exactly.
Well, even beyond pulling weapons, I think most people who have gamed for a long time have seen very earnestly hurt feelings over a game they've played in. And I think
I threw a notebook across the room one time. I was so pissed.
Yeah. Every once in a while, someone gets jilted who's the type to pull a gun.
Right.
And you get a story like that.
Yeah, you do. And, you know, I think you're right, Chad, that everyone's going to get pissed off at some point over something just because we're human. Yeah, I'm going to get pissed off at a role-playing game the same way I'm going to get pissed off at work. And, of course, it's just a game, which is the perspective you need to have, but that's not always there.
Right.
And you just got to be sure you're around people. And this just isn't for RPGs. This is life in general. Be sure you're surrounded by people who are sane enough that when they're mad, they can draw the line between throwing a notebook and pulling a gun.
Right.
I don't know. Crazy stuff. If you've got a story like that, email us and maybe we'll read some of these off next time, because it's a big enough hobby. You know there's crazy people out there.
I didn't know anybody who involved in this story. This is a story I heard at a convention panel. The purpose of the panel was sitting around telling crazy role-playing game stories that happened in real life. And this guy was talking about this thing where this LARPer had full suit of armor, metal armor, sword and stuff, and he was walking home from wherever, and he got mugged on the street. Hands over the wallet, I guess, runs up to his apartment, grabs his sword, puts on his helmet, runs downstairs, and starts chasing the guy with the sword.
Did he succeed?
I think the cops stopped him. And who knows if this is true or not. This is
A little fanciful.
It's a fun story.
It's another one, 150 XP.
Exactly.
Easily. I've definitely given the guy something good for that.
Yes.
Before we dig into anything else, I want to talk about something pretty big here. It's been looming over us for a while.
Huge.
What is it? Well, I hinted at this before, and I think it is finally time.
It's big, it's nasty, and it's polyhedral.
It is polyhedral, and we're going to get to that here in 1 second. Finally get this out of the way. We've been setting up for too many episodes.
But Batman or Superman?
Oh, come on. Like there'd be any debate at this table.
Please.
Batman.
Yeah, exactly.
Easily.
Most certainly.
Yeah, no question there.
Well, that's it for the podcast.
Yeah. See you guys later.
That was the issue.
Tail or wings?
Tail or wings?
Tail or wings. If you could have a fully functional prehensile tail or wings...
Do I lose my opposable thumbs and fingers if I take wings? No. Or do I have arms with feathers?
We'll assume that this is actually a fifth and sixth appendage.
Like an angel wing.
Yeah, or bat wings, if you
can
prefer.
Can I fly?
Well, yeah, that's the assumption.
Easily.
That's not a question.
Tail. Why do I need rear guidance if I can't fly?
Yeah.
We need some furry to write us in and give us the really detailed explanation.
I think we could get a really, really detailed explanation about what a furry can do with a tail, but I don't think we want it.
Venus on the Half Shell.
Send all of those. If you are a furry, if you're a furry and you have a great explanation of all the different uses for tails, please send that to our chief researcher, adam@feartheboot.com. That's adam@feartheboot.com. Pictures,
videos,
whatever everything. You can stick in there. We want it in there. All right. Let's go ahead and do it. You know what? I got an email here I want to get to, and hopefully we can get to at least a little bit this podcast.
All right.
But we've been sitting here on a topic for too long, and it's time to take what John calls a mental number two.
Well, damn it, what is it?
The D20 system.
Well,
we have talked about it for so long.
And we're actually playing it now.
Yes, we are.
We are actually playing it. All right, let me tell you, in general, what I think about the D20 system.
Crap.
It's a little more mixed than that.
That's what Chad thinks about it. Now,
right,
Dan.
Do we want to start with the good or the bad?
Give us your balanced good opinion, good followed by bad.
Yeah, let's all expound what we think is good.
All right, let's start off with what the good is. The first thing I will give the D20 system is I think overall, if you look at it simply as a standalone system, it is a pretty solid system.
It's balanced. It's fair.
It's well thought out. I mean, heck, it descends from D&D, which is probably one of the, if not the oldest RPG systems out there. So it's a well-developed system. That's definitely a good side of it. It works wonderfully in games that lend themselves to a swashbuckling, heroic feel, Dungeons and Dragons. I think even if we take West End system out of the picture, I think the D20 system works really well for Star Wars. And I wouldn't just say it works better for Star Wars.
Well,
I would say that,
difficult.
Too. Not that that would mean anything.
I mean, I like Yahtzee as much as the next man, but not with my Jedis.
Yeah, exactly. You know, beating West End system is kind of like taking a baseball bat to a three-year-old in a dark alley. So I wouldn't give it too many props
I've
there.
Heard it defended.
Really?
I've been in chat rooms where I am the sole proponent of the D20 Star Wars versus a group of West Enders.
I own a lot of dice, and I don't own enough D6s to play a West End Star Wars game.
Well, let me ask you this, John. Do they really have good, strong reasons, or is this just it's the way it's always been, and I want it to stay that way?
I'm tempted to just invalidate their arguments entirely by labeling them as nostalgic yearnings for childhood games gone past when their Han Solo clone could shoot out Star Destroyers with his D6 blaster of times 500, and they actually are that. So I'm just going to go ahead and do it. There were no coherent defenses. It was just screaming.
So that's the upside of the D20 system.
It's not West End Star Wars.
Well, no. Even that aside, like I said, I really do think it's a pretty solid system. Okay. Now, on the bad side of the D20 system, speaking purely as a rule system, because I want to hold off on talking about the design and marketing model of the D20 system. I'm not a big fan of systems with levels, and I think they work well for heroic feel systems, because you can have one guy who's so outrageously more powerful than anyone else around him.
Well, I solved that problem when I ran D&D. Nobody leveled.
Yeah. But I've never liked the reality-breaking feel of having one guy who's level 20, where he could take on a whole city worth of people, and no one there could probably even hurt him, and he's killing six of them around.
Right.
And just having that kind of broken scale of power. And this is purely a personal feel issue. I know some people probably say, well, you know what? That's level system's necessary to give me the heroic feel.
Right.
You know, you can't get a Lancelot if everyone's level one.
Or that's the reward of the game. But
right.
To me, I don't like that attitude, because the reward of the game should be the game itself. You know, occasionally you throw them, like, equipment or something, but the reward of the game should be the interaction with the NPCs, the following of the storyline, the plot, the solving of the mystery, the being the hero of the day, not being more able to kill other people.
I think the reward of the game is the game itself, but I will defend levels in that they provide a certain firm progression of getting better as a character. You could do it a few other ways. If you ran a military game, you could be basically the same dude you were when you were a private and become a corporal and a sergeant and lieutenant and so on. and move upward.
Right.
If you were playing a really backstab court intrigue courtiers game and you worked your way up through Duke and Baron and became the king, you could give progress that way. But I don't know. I like going from level 5 to level 6. I just think it's fun.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people who, that's their thing, just leveling up and building their character stat-wise and equipment-wise stuff, building up their characters.
Yeah, it's part of the challenge of role-playing, yeah. I think, to take a character whose perspective changes over time, and usually the fun way to do that is to take someone who goes from being weaker to stronger, although I guess you could go from use someone who falls from power.
Yeah, I think it just kind of almost contributes to a Diablo feel,
mm-hmm.
where
it can do that very, very easily.
Yeah, progression in the game becomes way too much the stat sheet.
Yep.
That your character ceases to be a background, a personality, a growing, defined person, and mm-hmm. just becomes, I have 50 hit points instead of 40, I have a +7 to hit instead of a +6, or whatever.
My ideal kind of game is for everyone to roll up characters and fill out the character sheets, and then hand them to me, and I put them in a folder, and nobody ever gets to look at them again.
Because you don't look at them either, because you just make us roll 2d6 and give us a good number when something comes up.
I lend more to the percentile, but it depends on what's on hand.
Of course.
Okay. Let's now put that aside. That has been the appetizer to the D20 system. This is where, really, my problem with the D20 system, my bigger problem with the D20 system begins. What it was intended to do.
Right.
All right, quick review for anyone who's not overly familiar with the D20 system.
It's the new GURPS.
Well, back, I guess, mid to late 90s, I don't have an exact year in front of me, you had a major crash in the RPG market. FASA went out of business, TSR went out of business. The role-playing market was either holding steady or nosediving all the way across every game. And there were some guys that sat down, and their work ended up with Wizards of the Coast. I'm not familiar with whether these guys actually were from Wizards mm-hmm. of the Coast to begin with, but they sat down and did a series of interviews on why aren't people getting role-playing games. And one of the big complaints they saw was that people felt the systems were too complex and there are too many of them to learn. So they take the system that had been native to D&D, rearrange it, add some new rules, change some existing rules, and I will say did do some pretty heavy overhauls to it, and come up with what they call the D20 system. They put this under an open license where anyone can print it, anyone can use it, anyone can adapt it to any game.
And I think that that is a really neat aspect of the D20 system, is that it is open and other people
right,
can use it.
Right.
That's really cool.
And we're definitely going to talk about that here in a sec. But what they ended up doing with that is now saying that they wanted this to become the one standardized system that is used for every genre, mm-hmm. every game. If you're a new guy coming into the market, don't bother making your own rule system. It's not worth doing. We don't want you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Just write up a setting, stick it with a few customized rules to tweak the D20 system for kind of what you want out of your game,
mm-hmm.
and you're now good to go. And it is that section of the D20 system where my real problem with it begins, because it has effectively, and I won't say it has killed innovation, because I think if you've got people out there that are bent on innovation, they will do it regardless of what's the standard.
Right.
We've seen that in any number of pursuits in all throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
But it has effectively said to the gaming community, the D20 system is not a comma in a long list of systems and innovations, but is rather intended to be a period.
Right.
That is the end of innovation. And anything you see hereafter is simply upgrades or tweaks to the D20 system. And a lot of players and a lot of game developers have jumped on that bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothers me. And not just because it kills innovation for innovation's sake, but because, as we talked about in a previous episode, rule systems simulate something.
Right.
They have a feel, and you cannot make the D20 system fit the feel of every game out there. Without changing so much about it, you don't have a consistent system anymore, thus defeating the original intention of the D20 system.
Right.
I don't know if I see it as a period so much as I see it as a semicolon.
Semicolon.
I'll give another analogy. IBM compatibility in the late 1980s. There were a lot of things you could do with other programming languages, but it was probably preferable for the average user to just be able to run everything on his home personal computer. Now, that's a little bit of an awkward analogy because rule systems are different than just mechanical protocols. They do have feels. But speaking as a guy who really is apprehensive of reinventing the wheel every time he starts a new game with regards to his system.
That was my fault. I'm sorry,
sees
John.
That happen a lot. Thanks, Chad. I really don't mind a backbone, a sort of Esperanto to fall back on if I don't want to invent anything new. And for most of my gaming tastes, D20 fits it. Although, like Dan said, not for all. It's not for everything.
Right. And, you know, that's a nuance I want to be sure is clear, is that I don't have this unabashed Chad-like hatred.
Hell, I'm playing it now.
I know.
I suggested it.
I'm just making fun of you because you are... If we need somebody to hate something, we can usually just throw it your way.
We can.
But I don't have this unabashed hatred for the D20 system. I hate what it has become as a symbol, that it has become this reigning standard that has really narrowed people's focus and people's interest.
I hate that aspect of it, and then I like that aspect of it. It's really weird because it has shaken up the market. Things are being done now because of the D20 system that weren't being done 20 years ago. Like, for instance, we have a friend who is trying to do this. You can start a business making custom D20 character sheets for your campaign setting.
Right.
You couldn't do that before.
And similarly, I mean, we know there are people listening to the show who are primarily into writing creatively,
right,
not technically. And this does enable someone who does not have an interest or a skill or both in math to sit down and say, I'm just going to focus all my attention on making a really detailed campaign setting. And
one of our listeners publishes D20 modern campaign settings and such.
Yeah.
And they're really good products.
And, you know, if this was something where I don't know why he chose to do that, but if he just does not have an interest in math or doesn't have a lot of skill in math or just doesn't want to be bothered with rules.
Or maybe he really likes a D20.
Yeah, or maybe he really likes the D20 system.
That's what he's doing.
But he can sit down, write the prose, publish it, and there you go.
Yeah.
And one thing that I'll give it props for that it has done is it has allowed, because you have this open source gaming system, it has allowed the small independent players to now make a product that is instantly recognizable on some level by everyone that would buy it.
I agree. A sort of innovation itself that has risen out of this system that, as you have probably rightly pegged, as a potential innovation smasher.
Yeah, and that's where my problem is I think it's become an icon that it shouldn't be.
Right.
That it's become the unassailable.
I wish that there were multiple systems like the D20 system. And I don't mean D20, D20 modern. I mean like totally separate,
right?
Not even involved with the D20 system rules, that were just like the D20 rules, that were as popular and competing with one another. Because I think that competition breeds change and innovation.
I agree with you. If they had, if there had not been just a D20 system, but if they had even released a library of, let's say, three systems.
Right.
One, you have like the D20, which is all heroic, a geometric system. Mm-hmm. You have one that's maybe more bell curved and more gritty.
Yeah. You got the sci-fi percentile dice system for.
Yeah. And if they had done something where they had released not one system, but a library of three systems, two systems, four
God
systems.
God forbid a company that isn't Wizards of the Coast releasing
them. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think I would have a much higher view of the whole thing.
Right.
Because at least I'd say, well, you've got consistency, but you've also got things that will fit different fields.
Yeah.
We have someone on our website who talked about, and I don't think he's ever explained this unless I missed the post. See, an example of a game I would say where the D20 system is just all wrong, front to bottom, all left to right, is the Battletech system.
Right.
Because
it's our cherished favorite
one.
And
it's not just that.
Besmirch it.
But it was designed for a broad bell curve.
Right.
It was designed for gritty feel. It was designed for characters that don't level up. I mean, you don't want a guy hitting a level so high he can punch out a battle mech.
Right.
And he actually adapted. He just said Battletech. I don't know if he meant Mech Warrior or the map combat, but one of them to the D20 system. Yeah. I would think. I can't imagine.
Map combat, D20.
I mean,
that's disgusting.
What is like an Atlas, like a level 20 mech? And a
well, that's how a lot of the modern video games would have you feel.
Yeah, they would, but we won't even
Battletech
go there.
Video games, yeah.
So that's my take in a nutshell of the D20 system. That's why I tend to rage against it, even though in truth, I don't really hate it as much as I may come off as.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, hell, I think the proof is we're playing it.
Yeah, we're playing it, yeah.
Currently, that is we dropped Battletech and we're playing a game of D&D.
Like you've never heard a gamer rail against a game for being awful and terrible and this, that, and the other, while he himself wasn't paying to play it.
Star Wars.
We hear that
we've
every day.
The Star Wars
Western
game.
Star Wars.
And we're felt dirty while we did it. And I'm not even a Star Wars fan, and I played it.
I got an email from someone here I want to read, and we're going to respond to one part of it, but not another. And after I read his email, I'll tell you which part we're responding to and why we're not.
The part with the bizarre naked pictures of himself.
Yes, right.
And the gophers.
No comment.
Yeah, please don't send us emails like that.
Send Adam emails.
Adam
like
at feartheboot.com.
He's our local pathologist.
Yes. If you're Furries. A big, ugly, hairy man and you want to send a naked picture, Adam at feartheboot.com. He's our editor-in-chief of that kind of thing, reviews them, and decides what to do with them.
Yep.
So I got an email from a guy named Tristan, and Tristan writes and says, "Hey, guys, I recently found your podcast and enjoy listening to you talk about RPGs. I've never played a tabletop RPG before, but have heard about it and would be willing to give it a try, though most of my free time is spent at home with my wife. I was wondering if you know of any good, fun, free, or low-cost tabletop RPGs for two players. Am I doomed to just play WoW?" Now, first of all, Tristan, nobody listens to this podcast is doomed to just play WoW. We like MMOs.
Yeah.
But
I've got 360s on WoW.
Yeah, you can get something out of a tabletop RPG you just can't get
right.
out of WoW.
Yeah.
Because
to me, WoW is the automated dungeon crawl. And I would never want to do a dungeon crawl unless it was automated. So
now, the part that we're going to respond to here is actually the very end of it where you asked, can we suggest any games for just two people? Now, we are not going to respond to the first part of it where you asked about how would we recommend getting someone new into the hobby. And to be more specific, we're not going to respond to that right here. We have actually for a while been wanting to make a bonus episode that is geared specifically to people that are wanting to get into the hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to tell you about the products you need, good games to start on, bad games to start on, how to teach people about it. We'll probably even explain in kind of a quick session what a role-playing game can be like.
Yeah, we have to define what it is because that's not even agreed upon, much less obvious.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But since most of the people that listen to our podcast are established role players, we didn't want to spend a standard episode on that. However, very soon, within the next couple of weeks, expect to see a bonus episode on this exact subject.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tristan, for now, we're only going to respond to that one part of your email, which is what can you do with two people? In fact, we're going to go a little bit broader than that, and we're going to talk about unusual setups for role-playing groups in general. Because in my mind, the ideal role-playing
group...
All hot chicks?
Well, yes. Well,
go.
Then I'm not playing.
Right.
And one ugly guy, all hot
one
chicks.
One ugly guy, the rest hot chicks. But my ideal setup for a role-playing game is one game master
mm-hmm.
and 3 to 5 players.
I like one game master 5 to 6, but that's just...
I like 4 to 6. I think we're split on this issue, and this is going to require some serious debate.
That's right.
Right, but what I think we can agree on, or what our spreads seem to agree on, is the fact that if you are down to a game master and one player, or maybe a game master and two players, you have an unusually small group.
Yes.
And if you have a game master and 7 players, 8 players, 9 players, you have an unusually large group. And this radically changes the dynamic of what's going on and the things you need to do to make the role-playing game work. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about how you can make a role-playing game work in an unusually big or an unusually small group. You want to start big or small?
Let's go small and work our way up.
All right, let's go small. All right, first of all, let's say you just have 2 people.
Have you ever played in a 2-person, like, lone wolf game?
Yes, I have.
I myself have not. You have, Dan.
I have.
I haven't for many a long year, and the game we called it when we were 10 years old was not a role-playing game. It was Kill Orcs with Dice. Anyway, Dan.
I did
a great game.
Yeah.
I did, actually. Yeah, I have played in Lone Wolf games. I am having trouble remembering if I've ever GM'd them or not, and I'm not sure that I have.
Mm-hmm.
But I know for a fact I have played now in a couple Lone Wolf games. And I will have to say, the dynamic is really, really different, and
mm-hmm.
I'll get to that in a second. But that kind of unusual feel aside, they actually did work out pretty well. I actually had a lot of fun doing them. And why they feel so strange is in a normal role-playing game, it's really about a social dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
That you are sitting at a table with 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever other people, and you are all interacting with each other, interacting with the GM. Your player is just part of, or rather your character, is just part of a mosaic of what's going on, you know, helps build this whole situation. You're getting only part of the GM's time. You can't develop anything that's just centered around you for too terribly long because you'll bore the other people. And you just kind of fall into the system.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a lone wolf role-playing game, it is just about your character. You therefore have to consistently be thinking, consistently be responding, because there's nobody else there to jump in. And what that allows on the flip side is you can develop that character in a lot of ways. You can stop and for 20 minutes think about just what this character's thinking in his head.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can spend a whole 3-game series just going back home to deal with your parents.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it's kind of a strange thing.
Yeah,
but
that's kind of what we go to the games to away from.
And that's just a bad example.
Yeah.
But you get the point that it's things you cannot necessarily do with a group you can do now. And on the upside, it allows you to really get into a character in a way you couldn't otherwise.
Hmm.
The downside is it can get a little bit weird.
Yeah, that would be my
really
problem.
Really weird to me.
When I say that it looks weird to me, I don't mean it looks weird in like a creepy LARPer sexual sense, or it's like too intimate, or...
Oh, it approaches that for me. But what do you mean, Chad?
I don't know. It's sort of an intangible for me. I really enjoy interacting with other people and playing my ideas off of them, and just to say that I'm sitting there and I'm the one doing all the role playing. I mean, minus the NPCs that the game master is doing. I don't know. Sometimes in a role playing game, part of my enjoyment is sitting back a little bit and watching the other players in the story unfold and then interjecting myself.
Absolutely. Me too. On another hand, I like to try to at least maintain the illusion that I'm doing something a little more elaborate than sitting in the basement and playing pretend. and other player characters to define my own with and against and bounce my story off of, other creative minds to sort of feel a plot out with, help me do that. They get me somewhere, I think, that I couldn't go if I just had a GM.
I think that that would be a fun thing to do with, like, a significant other, you know, who is equally as into
it as my. That's a different manner of role play, sir.
Well, I mean, it could lead to that, I'm sure, but no, I mean, I think...
Natural 20. All right.
Right, yeah, this is a topic for another podcast, and I don't mean another episode, I mean
no, another
podcast.
Yeah.
Not ours.
Well, I wasn't taking it there, but, you know, I'm just talking about the level of intimacy.
Right.
There would be a certain level of intimacy that you would have to make that lone wolf game really good, if it wasn't just rolling dice and killing things. But to really get into one-on-one role-playing, I don't know. I mean, I could be wrong. I've never done it.
Right. So, Tristan, at least me personally, I'm not saying it can't work. In fact, I've had some really good games, Lone Wolf, but it is going to be very different than playing with a large group of people. And it's, honestly, in ways, it's kind of hard to define. We took our best stab at it, but it's the sort of thing you just got to experience both sides for yourself, and you'll understand what we're getting at. Now, let's talk about games that are good for a small number of people.
Are you talking like a lone wolf game, or are you talking like just a small group? Two, three, four.
I'm
talking two players at most, typically lone wolf.
Mm.
Games that work well for that. Off the top of my head, easiest one is Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, that's
It's a game about heroes.
Yes.
It's about playing an eccentric person. D&D works very well.
Yeah.
I might object, actually, and say that D&D is written for 4 to 6 player characters, and that... Well, classes need other complementary classes. You can DM around that.
Right.
You can give the fighter a bunch of healing potions.
Well, there was, I remember reading a couple of Dragon magazines where they featured articles about lone wolf campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, if they weren't giving you a specific campaign setting for a lone wolf thing, the only thing that they were really talking about was, how do you get healing?
Gotcha.
I mean, that was pretty much the gist of it.
But like John said, you can GM around that. You know, if that's your problem, you can stick in an unusual number of healing potions in the loot.
Kind of just
or
fudge it a little.
You can throw them an NPC or retainer who is of a complementary class. Another game that I think would work well for a single person is the much controversy Shadowrun. Because if you had the right story that was really about one person's history, their pursuit of revenge or justice or personal wealth or whatever, you can develop that person's backstory and their run, or rather their life outside of the runs, in a lot of detail you just can't devote any time to if you've got a group there.
Yeah.
My story would be brief and tragic because my character failed to accept reality around him and ended his existence, tortured as it was. Fanboy that I am on another game system, I would go ahead and recommend, Battletech. You can be the commander of the lance and hog the spotlight all you want. No one will care. And in map battles, you can command all 4 mechs.
Yeah. If you did Battletech from the perspective of your lone wolf game, you're going to have NPC retainer types following you around.
Oh, yeah, you have
to. Structure. You could do that, yeah. I wouldn't do it where you're by yourself. I think Shadowrun, you can actually do it where you are alone.
Right.
D&D, you can kind of sort of do it. Battletech, you can't do it all. You have to have
You could if you ran a Solaris campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was very much meant for one man climbing the ladder. So if you're if you want to play Battletech, Lone Wolf, you've got to have crap loads of NPCs. Yeah. Or you've got to do something like a Solaris campaign.
I think one-on-one mech fights are boring.
Oh, I agree with you, but
it's just whoever rolls higher.
Yeah, it's very much
and
luck.
Even in a situation where you were part of a lance, damn, I'd rather have three other player characters going around me.
Yeah.
But that's outside
the
realm
of
this. Exactly. That's outside the realm of this discussion.
All right. And a lot of what is within the realm of this discussion, though, actually, and you're kind of going that direction. So let's talk real quick about games that don't work in a small group of people. And I think I can sum up those kinds of games with one simple sentence. And from there, we can go to name some. Do not pick a game that is fundamentally geared towards the presence or hands-on skills of other player characters. Good example, Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
If you play,
you have to fill out all the bridge positions.
Right. If you want to beam down to a planet with your away team in Star Trek, and you can only be one position. Mm-hmm. You know, you are the science officer, you're the captain, you're the engineer. You ain't six people.
Right.
And it's very, very, it's a very awkward game when you're on planet and there's all these mysteries about life and technology and this, that, and the other. And you're just like, okay, game master, I ask Mr. So-and-so about this. Well, he tells you that. Okay. All right, now I ask Mr. So-and-so about that. Okay, well, he tells you this. Mm-hmm. And pretty quickly, you've got the GM just handing you the plot.
I think the other side of the coin would be games like, and I think that a lot of people would disagree with me on this one, would be Vampire the Masquerade and Call of Cthulhu. And the reason is that these are high role-playing games. You do a lot of character interaction. And
right, that has nothing to do with the game master.
Right, you can only interact with the handful of NPCs that the game master throws out at you at the same time, because you're always looking at that same face. A lot of your character development is, when you role-play and don't turn either of those games into a combat game,
right,
is interacting with your friends, your people around you.
And you know, I think you're right on that. I had put this in terms of skills and plot.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right that it's not just a mechanical thing. If you need a softer element of the game, like role-playing, that requires other people, I think you're right. That's mm-hmm. also obviously not a good idea for a lone wolf sort of game.
Right.
So you got to find games that don't require other people for skills or for role-playing interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Things where you can make it more about kind of the hard mechanics of the story to develop your character. Well, let's go to the opposite extreme, large groups.
Ugh.
Biggest group I've ever played in,
I was there for this,
was 11 people at one sitting.
Disgusting.
11 people.
That's gross.
And this was not a dungeon crawl. This was a detailed, plot-oriented game.
Yeah, this is not like some sort of map combat or anything.
Yeah, this was not a big map combat. This was not a tournament. That was a standard plot-driven role-playing game like we espouse on this show. John, what was your...
Yeah, right now, actually, I'm in a Star Wars game that I think has 9 PCs, maybe just 8. And again, it's not a tournament game. The players have some very different motivations for being there, but there are several very developed, very intricately crafted player characters, and lots of them have dynamics with one another. And I like it, but the DM kind of has to really do a lot of juggling to keep everything in place.
Now, before we even try and take a stab at how you would make a large group work, my first most simple advice to you is if you have a group that big, it's time to split.
Yeah,
now, I don't mean split your friends, but I mean you need to count, play duck, duck, goose, count heads. And you need to cut your group in half and have 5 people in one room playing one game and 5 people in another room playing the other.
If you've only got one natural DM in your group, try to make a synthetic one.
Yeah, teach someone how to do it. In fact, it was not that game, but actually I was at another sit-down where 14 people showed up.
Ugh.
And no game actually came out of this. Well, actually, let me correct that. 2 games came out of this. There were so many people there that we had no choice but to split into 2 groups. And one group was playing World of Darkness. I think the other was playing Star Wars.
Well, the big one with 11 people, we actually, the one that you were at too, we actually got a sub-GM, an assistant GM. We divided up into 2 groups. We were playing the same game and the same plot and the same campaign.
Right.
And the GMs every once in a while got together and, you know, shared notes, talked about what they're doing, made sure they were both on the right track, and went back. And were running, and the two groups would, like, affect each other, but not in a cool way. It was in a very cumbersome, boring,
and
stupid way.
You know, outside of split your group, what you've just mentioned there is the only way I can come up with to make a large group work, which is multi-GMing.
Well, let me ask you guys this. Why doesn't a 12-man, 1-GM group
That's a good question. And, John, do you want to feel this one?
I'll feel this one.
All right, good.
I'll just give the example of my current Star Wars game. And I'll be as nice as I can to it because it's a well-run game, but there are certain mechanical realities that surround it. I sit next to one of my fellow MUD players who has her laptop out during the game because sometimes several hours or perhaps entire sessions pass in which people don't have actions.
Or a voice or
anything. The camera. Not to mention the spotlight. One human GM just can't bring them all in.
Exactly. I
can only juggle so many people in an action at one time, and six is my limit. And even with six, it's rare that I get every single person in the same room,
right?
Virtually in the same room doing the same thing. And I'm like ping-ponging back and forth,
right,
working my tail off to make sure nobody sitting around me is bored.
Now, before we get into multi-GMing, which is something you brought up and I actually want to develop in detail, which will probably carry us to the end of the episode because the final type of multi-GMing actually has nothing to do with your group size. But I don't want to talk about multi-GMing without completing the whole category of multi-GM games.
So, I'll allow it.
Okay, thank you. But let's talk real quick about what are some games that could possibly work with a large group. Let's say we have someone in the audience who has a massive group who just for whatever reason does not want to break it up and does not want to multi-GM. My only suggestion is to find games that rely very heavily on player-to-player interaction where they only need you the smallest amount of time. Going to the reverse of the small group, Star Trek works wonderfully. Mm-hmm. You throw a mystery their way. If you do a good one, and I've done this with large groups for Star Trek, they spend so much time talking to each other, debating the mystery at hand and the things that are going on and whatever, that they typically only come back to me every couple of minutes to say, all right, now, wait a minute. I'm going to run a tricorder over this. What kind of reading do I get back? And I tell them, and they go back and debate it some
more. And Gene Roddenberry's political analogy just comes right up on the tricorder and no one even has to think.
Oh, my.
Oh, snap. Oh, my.
Not a Star Trek fan?
Oh, I like Star Trek. But I smell it for what it is.
Well, yeah, Gene Roddenberry is a big socialist humanist, whatever, and he made no attempt to hide that. So that's one is I don't think World of Darkness. If you got a group that's real heavy into the personal level roleplay, the roleplay that's not necessarily plot oriented, like for example, Chad, we've had games where the game master's just sitting there twiddling his thumbs because the characters get involved in such deep conversations about what's going on purely from an emotive standpoint that we carry things along. And I could see games like World of Darkness, if you've got a group that's really into that, lending themselves to that, where you almost don't even need a GM.
To me, a good World of Darkness game is where the players, the GM starts them off, and the players are going, and whenever the momentum slows a little bit, the GM kind of comes in and pokes them a little.
Now, to me, a good World of Darkness game is Hunter's Hunted, but we'll save that rant for a different podcast. Yeah. Let's go ahead and put aside actual games here for a second, now talk about multi-GMing. And this is a possibility for large groups. This is also a possibility you can use outside of large groups, though the first two of the three kinds of multi-GMing we're going to mention are mainly meant, in our minds, for large groups. The first is to have several at once with no division of labor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, an example of this, when we had that 11-man game, I and another guy were co-GMing. Now, we did not have specific tasks. It's not like he was the combat GM and I was the plot GM, or he GM'd this area, I GM'd that area, or he GM'd RP and one of us did the map comments, or whatever. It wasn't like that. It was simply we both had agreed upon a plot. We had some gentleman agreements about where it was headed, and we would just go back and forth between groups of people or individual players, making sure that everyone was involved in the action. And if three guys walk into the same room, okay, one of the GMs grabs them and starts GMing for them. The other guy entertains the rest of them.
I must ask, did one of you wear the daddy pants, or were you a castle with two lords?
We did, kind of. There was no, well, as I said, there's no official division of labor. He was more the expert in the universe, and I was more the expert in the rule system.
Gotcha. Why I ask is that I can see a fissure between two GMs over even a minor issue destroying a game if one of them didn't have clearly demarked authority to begin with.
Yeah, big time. You got to have people get along. Because if they don't get along, this will real quickly degrade into a huge pissing contest.
Yeah.
Big time. The second kind of multi-GMing we can talk about is GMs, two or more GMs with a division of labor. Now, I've never actually sat in a game like this, but we have talked about it. So I can imagine that such a thing could be done. Where, let's say if we're talking about Battletech, when you're out of your mech, one guy GMs you. When you're in your mech, another guy GMs you.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you have...
Well, like D&D, where one guy runs the story, the plot, the characters, and one guy runs the combat.
Right.
You know, the other guy just doesn't, like myself. I would have to do that.
That almost sounds like the job of a deputy PC more than a GM.
Yeah.
You could get a trustee. Honest and rules literate player character to fulfill that role.
You know, something else, and this was actually done with only one GM, but you could easily do this with two GMs, was he was running a plot line for two groups that were experiencing different aspects of the same plot line, but they would affect each other. And now this was one GM going back and forth between two groups on different nights, but I could see that being done with two GMs on one night, that you have one campaign in mind, one overarching plot that
you could have guest appearances from the other group.
Honestly, yeah. I mean, as silly as it sounds,
that would be kind of cool.
But you have this thing like, you know, group one's going to go to this planet and deal with the mercenaries, and group two is going to go to that planet and deal with the evil Sith Lord or whatever.
I've seen that tried on forums, actually. One boat was full of good characters and one boat was full of evil characters, and they were both commissioned to find the gem or whatever, they were going to meet eventually.
This one wasn't competitive, but you could do it that way as well. Yeah. You could definitely do it competitive, so that's your shtick. Now, the third and final way, and this has nothing to do with the size of your group, but if you can do it right, this can be a lot of fun, but there can also be some potential problems, is to rotate GMs.
I love it myself.
Let me give an example of how...
We've had a really good group with that.
Right. We've done this twice now, you and I have done this twice, and you did it. I'm sorry, you and I have done this once, and you did this a second time.
And I was there.
Yeah, and you were there for that. So let's talk real quick about the two kind of setups we had.
Yeah, they were different ways of doing it.
The setup we did originally was to avoid any possible overlap between GM decisions or setting descriptions, was we took D&D characters, started them at level 1, and the first GM ran them through a generic setting from like level 1 to 4 or 1 to 5 or something like that, at which point they fall asleep. The gods zap them, whatever. They wake up in...
The mists of Ravenloft.
You know, they wake up in Forgotten Realms, and for Forgotten Realms, they go to Dragonlance, from Dragonlance to Ravenloft.
That sounds gross.
Yeah, but it actually was a lot of fun because it gave everyone a chance to GM, and it was very sterile because you didn't have any possibility to GM step on each other's toes because you effectively reset the campaign setting every time a new GM took over. Same characters, same continuity of plot, but... Everything got washed clean and reset when the next GM took over.
So it was Sliders, the medieval RPG. I call John Rhys Davis.
All right, now, Chad and John, you guys did something that was somewhat different than this. So why don't you talk about that?
What we did is we set up a rotation of GMs. You know, this guy would go, and then this guy. We'd go around in a circle. And we would take 2 weeks.
Right.
We would all have the same characters. It would be one storyline. We wouldn't jump from realm to realm,
Although our setting was generic such that no one could possibly screw it up.
It was a very generic medieval fantasy realm. And we had agreements between us before we went out. We said that, okay, I'm going to start this and we're going to kind of kick it off. When it's the next person's turn, any NPCs that I come up with, any story I had come up with, anything, equipment, levels, whatever I'd given or come up with, would be handed to the next GM. I could not sit there when it isn't my turn and somebody's running around an NPC I made up and acting like he shouldn't act. I cannot say, well, that's not how that guy would act. I wrote him different.
So for example...
I gave up ownership of it.
So for example, maybe something like this. In the first game, you take them to talk to the king. This is a popular analogy with us.
Yes.
And the king says, go kill the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And they go to a town and a couple things happen. Now your 2 weeks is up and let's say John takes over.
Right.
And now if John wanted to, he could have the dragon show up and say, no, actually, you've misunderstood me. The king's the evil guy.
Yeah.
Or the king was the dragon polymorph. Now they have to fight him in battle.
Right, which was maybe something you never intended.
Yeah. Now, you could take that from, well, there'd be competition between right. the GMs and they would do things. And it wasn't like that. It was like we developed a flow. You know, there in the first game, I established bad guys and we right. would work towards that and stuff. And there really wasn't any competition where one person said, well, you know, this plot is totally stupid, so I'm going to flush it or I'm going to do this right. major turn. You know, they put their own spin and their own flavor on it. Now, what things that did happen would be like I introduced this one kind of monster, and he was really unique, and there was mm-hmm. only one of them, and they fought him. They had a big battle with him and such. And when he was dead, that was it. That was what I had in mind for it. Well, one of the other GMs liked the monster so much, when it became her turn, they went into a town, and there were like five or six of these things in the town going crazy, and it was like...
Just out of curiosity, and it's sounding like no, but John, did you guys have any gentleman's agreements that I, you know, hey, don't mess with this GM, or not GM, NPC, mm-hmm. or no. don't give them big swords of +5? Or,
no.
Well, balance items, we had the gentleman's nod.
Right.
Nobody was dropping Vorpal swords.
Yeah.
Right.
However, there was nothing hard written. The GM had the world for 2 weeks.
Yeah, and we're not the kind of gamers where we really... had Vorpal swords.
Yeah,
right.
It doesn't get our rocks off to get the Holy Avengers, right. So you don't even have to worry about us giving it to each other.
We made probably about, what, 1.5 rotations through before it kind of fell apart?
I only think we made one.
And of course I can say this because he's not here. It got to Adam, and Adam just blew it. He is not a GM. He's a really new player, and when it got to him, he just... at the time, didn't know what to do with it.
Adam's the type of person, I'm going to go and talk about him because he's not here. And
yes.
You know, he doesn't listen to this podcast.
Yeah, of course
right
not.
So
he'll never know.
Yeah.
But when I talk to Adam, I see someone who I think actually has a lot of potential to be a very good GM. He's got the mind for it.
Yes.
I think what he lacks is experience and confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And he even told me that. We actually had an email conversation about this where he was saying that, you know, I'm worried about a good GM. And I was like, just talking to you intuitively.
Yeah.
You'd be a good GM. You just need
experience.
He loves
the story.
Right.
You know, he is all about the story.
Right.
And he said that the next time, now, I know all the people listening just really care about what's going on in our group, but he said that the next time... you know, you're running D&D now. I just finished BattleTech. You're running D&D. When your D&D game is done, he wants to run a game, and he actually wants to use all the different resources and advice that we've done here on Fear the Boot, because we don't use our own advice, because
we use some of it.
I think GMing is a process of discovering one's own potential, a lifting the X-Wing out of the swamp, if you will, that no one can do for you but you.
Right.
And I'm sure everyone will come across
if
he wants to.
I can't wait till he does it and uses all the Fear the Boot stuff. So
see what happens.
Yeah, let's see if it worked, if we're talking out of our butts.
This is partially because here at Fear the Boot, we all have somewhat different views.
Yeah.
But everything in the resources section, while those are things I made up for the show, I can say honestly, those are things where I have used those exact techniques to run games in the past.
Yeah.
So I would disagree that I have used Fear the Boot's advice.
Don't get me wrong. I don't think that what we're saying here is worthless and we're just making it up we have content. No, I think all that, and I'm not saying this just to sell the concept of Fear the Boot either. All that stuff we have used at some point or another.
Right.
I don't think that we've used it all once and
no,
brought
we haven't.
It all together at once. Why don't we use that stuff? Lazy?
Oh, I said, yeah, some of that I think is laziness, but some of it we have used. I mean, we've used group templates such in the past. But
character surveys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually one we hadn't even put up yet. So,
well,
maybe we'll talk about that at some future show.
Next show is the ladies show.
Yeah, next show is the ladies show.
We should definitely talk about character surveys.
All right. Well, I said we would carry this show out talking about multi-GMs. Instead, we carried it out gossiping about Adam and then gossiping about ourselves.
Yeah.
But hey, that's what you get here at Fear the Boot. You just have no idea what's going to come up. We have no idea what's going to come up. So,
not really.
What's going to come up next time? We don't know, but we will find out then.
Hopefully it's the ladies. See ya.
Ta-ta.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.